This episode of Open Mind is sponsored by very.co.uk. The Very Christmas Shop is ready and they've got everything you need for the coolest of yules, including Christmas gifts for all the family, decorations to deck your halls, fun Christmas ideas to keep everyone entertained, and all the most wanted Christmas presents on their wish lists. From tots to teens and big kids too, just go to very.co.uk and search Christmas. Hi, welcome back to Open Mind with me, Frankie Bridge. This is actually the last episode of this series, which is just insane. Like, didn't even think I'd have my own podcast, and now here I am at the end of a series. So amazing. And to finish it off nicely, it's someone that I've actually wanted to get on for quite a few weeks, and she's been a hard woman to pin down. It's only blooming Jenny Ryan. So she is the vixen on the chase, and she's just been in the final of X Factor Celebrity. Hi, Jenny.
Hello, thanks for having me.
That's all right. We actually had a random night out once, didn't we?
We did. Like, it was good. We ended up doing a mini pop quiz.
Which, oh no. Yeah. Was I good at that, Jenny?
Or? Well, you were actually trying to quiz me. you and Wayne were singing or humming pop songs, no. And I had to identify them, but it was impossible. Maybe some drink had been taken, though.
I'm not sure now who comes off worse on this, the fact that you couldn't understand my humming or that you didn't know them. So I think we both take a hit on this one.
Yeah, no disgrace, though.
I feel like with you, it's only been over the last few weeks that we're properly getting to know the real Jenny Ryan. Because mm-hmm. I feel like on The Chase, you're kind of this character, aren't you?
Yeah.
I mean, you're called the vixen.
Yeah, it's almost literally a caricature. It's a character that I get dressed up as. You know, there's a costume and there's a hair style to go with it, and it all ties into that being the vixen character is not quite me. Mm. You don't get to see who I really am, and part of that is putting up this huge front of being, you know, strong, impenetrable, really tough. And, you know, a little bit condescending and a little bit snarky sometimes if the contestants give me reason to be. But so that's not quite who I am really, but it does help to have that suit of armour, basically, when I walk out, to be the vixen, to have that shield. And it gives me a bit of licence to have a bit more confidence, really.
Because there's quite an expectation on you, I feel, to be, you have to be super intelligent, know loads about everything, basically. For someone like me watching, I'm like, oh, she just knows everything, doesn't she? Like, how does she know this stuff? And I feel like that's quite a lot of pressure for you. So I guess the suit of armour helps with that, right?
Yeah, it's as soon as I have to put on my outfit in the same order. It's a bit of a superstition. So soon as I've put, the last thing I put on are the glasses which I'm not allowed to take home because they're far too precious.
Wow.
They are property of ITV, and God forbid anything should ever happen to those glasses. As soon as that pair of glasses goes on, though, I'm falling into character, and then just the short walk into the studio means that I've got that time to sort of get into my element. Mm. And to push away, you know, all those doubts, because it's not helpful in that situation to be conscious of all that pressure that is on you, because that's when you start to make mistakes. If you go in there with utter confidence, you are less likely to make the mistake, even though you're the same person, you've got the same knowledge, you've prepared in the same way every single time, you've read all the same stuff in the lead up to the quiz. That shield, that suit of armour that is the costume and that is the character, gives you that edge, and it means that you can put to one side the thought that there are, you know, 5 million people going to be watching, and if you make a slip up, they are going to be all over you.
They're so happy about it. Like, I'm not going to lie, when I'm watching The Chase and one of you gets it wrong, I love it. I am like, yeah, in
Meanie.
Your face. Oh, like, it's such a good feeling. I always think the person that's standing there must be like, yeah.
Yeah, we literally can't know everything. And it would be so boring if we got every single question
right,
every time.
I wouldn't get that excitement of one of you getting
it's
it right.
That little bit of joy of, you know, getting one over on someone who's supposed to be better than you.
And did you think your life would end up that way? Like, what was your goal when you were younger? Because I can't imagine a quiz show on ITV was like, you know,
there was no such thing as making money out of being a quizzer. It was always my hobby. When I was about 8, I started, you know, watching shows like Perry Mason and things that had lawyers in, and I decided that what I wanted to be was a barrister. And that was what the only thing I wanted to be.
At the age of 8?
At the age of 8. So everything was focused on, I'm going to go to university, do a law degree, then I'll take the bar, and then, you know, I'll get admitted to one of the ends of court, and in the end I'll be a QC, and maybe then I'll go into politics. And I had all this trajectory set out for myself.
Wow.
From being at primary school. And things just didn't pan out that way in the end. I mean, I did go and do a law degree, and I did summer placements and work experience at some big law firms. And that's when it dawned on me that the industry was not for me. I could see it. It's great for a lot of people. One thing I hated about it was that it was potentially quite backstabby in that this big law firm that I did a summer placement at had all these students coming in, and they were supposed to try and entice them into taking a job with them or taking the training contract. So you do a training contract for a couple of years, and at the end of it, you're a qualified solicitor, and it means that you can go and get a job anywhere, but maybe at the place that you've done your training. So we were being buttered up to apply for the training contract by the current trainee solicitors. And we were being taken out for meals, and we were being shown round everywhere and getting let into all these little trade secrets. And it got to the Friday, and it was let slip to me by one of the trainee solicitors that for every job that was available in that company at the end of the training contract, there were 3 trainees. So at some point, a switch was going to be flipped. And they were all just going to have to start one-upping each other and working hard. So there were none of them had taken any holiday in the previous year. They'd built up so much loo time that they couldn't take that holiday.
Yeah.
The only breaks they were going on were work trips. And they were all sort of eyeing each other up for who was the weak link. Oh, I'm better than them, so I've got a better chance, but maybe they're a bit too strong. And I hated that. It made me feel so uncomfortable.
Because it was so competitive, or?
Because it was competitive, but not in a the way that I'm competitive. I'm competitive with myself. And I don't like a competition where it's a zero sum. I don't like I win so you lose. That's not nice for me. Which is ironic considering what my job is, but I mean,
it's a game, isn't it?
It is a game, and my job, I'm competitive with myself on the chase in that I'm contracted to try and win every single show to get as many questions right as I can. So that's me, I'm competing with myself on that ground. If the contestants are good enough to happen to beat me on a show, then that's great because they've beaten me. It's not that I've lost. Mm. I've still done my very best. And yeah, we've still got to lose the odd show in order for it to continue to be interesting. I just didn't like this very personal one-upmanship, every man for himself, because I'm somebody who likes to support other people and to see everybody do the best and everybody to achieve. And it made me uncomfortable, and it made me think that it wasn't the industry I should be in, and made me think about what I did enjoy. And what I do enjoy is creativity and bringing joy to people. And yeah, entertainment, darling, entertainment.
So is that when you decided then, right, I'm not going to do this? Like, how did you make the change?
It was a big decision because, yeah, I've wanted to do this since I was 8. And when I got to university and I found that I wasn't really enjoying my course as much as I'd thought I would, it was really tricky. I'm the only kid of my generation in my family. So my mum's the eldest of 5, and she had me when she was quite young. And then her siblings had children when they were older. So there's a huge gap between me and my cousins. So I was like the baby, the genius baby of the family. Everybody expected huge things of me. Everybody was bigging me up all the time. And the fact that I'd chosen this career and I was making it come true and was going to university. And I got there, and in the first few weeks, I thought I'd made a huge mistake, but I didn't think there was any way I could turn it around. I didn't want to admit I'd made a mistake, and I didn't want to upset my mum, really. I didn't want to upset my family by saying, actually, everything you thought about me is wrong. And this, you know, if I could have changed to an English literature degree, if I thought that was possible in the first couple of weeks, then that's what I should have done. Mm. However, if I had done that, I wouldn't be sitting here now. So you've got to think about those sliding doors things.
Yeah, but it wasn't that you couldn't do it.
Mm.
I'm sure you were like capable of doing it.
Yeah.
You just didn't like it. So it wouldn't have been that they would have been disappointed that you weren't able to.
Yeah, I think I'd just put a bit too much stock in my own pride and their pride in me. And I thought it was this fixed thing. It's taken, you know, many years for me to realise that their pride in me is not just for one thing. My mum keeps saying that she's proud of me, but she'd be proud of me whatever I chose to do. And I could never disappoint her, which it's great to know, but you hear that when you're a kid and you're like, yeah, I need to go and forge my own path. And actually that's the absolute truth, because she's been proud of me on some occasions, she's been proud of me for getting out of the house because it has been that tough.
And has it always been like that for you? Have you struggled with your mental health for years, or what way do you suffer?
Yeah, I didn't know what was wrong with me when I was a teenager. Something changed when I was at school and I couldn't figure it out. And we're talking, it's over 20 years ago now, so things weren't quite as open and honest, and the education wasn't there in school. So I didn't know that there was anything the matter with me in a physical or like brain chemistry way. I thought maybe I'm just like lazy. Maybe I'm not as clever as everybody thinks, because I stopped achieving as much as I was doing. I was coasting for the longest time, and then suddenly I found myself sort of almost incapable of even doing the homework. Like it was a struggle to pick up the book, and I didn't know what was wrong with me until I actually, you know, I scraped through my exams, didn't do as well as I thought I would, and then got to university. And in the first semester, I went to the GP because I was having more physical symptoms that, you know, I was having what I now know to be anxiety attacks, and finding it, you know, a struggle to get out of bed, and finding it, you know, really difficult to engage with other people, just wanting to be by myself. And it was suggested that I go to the doctor. I can't remember who it was who suggested it. And I'm so glad that they did, because the doctor went, well, you've got depression. I was, but I can't, how can I have depression? Because what have I got to be depressed about? I'm at a really good university. I've got, you know, my whole life ahead of me. What is there to be depressed about? And then you find out more about it. This is where my learning bug kicks in, and it really helped that you read more about it and you find that it's a chemical problem. It's a physical thing that's affecting the way that your brain is functioning and your emotions are functioning. And that was a revelation to me. So I'd probably had been struggling with depression since my early teens, but I didn't know until I was 18, 19 that that's what it was.
And did that make you feel better to kind of have someone go, you know what, this is what it is, or did it freak you out?
In the first instance, it made me feel better. And then it was, well, how do I cure it? And it was difficult then to figure out do I go on medication? I tried various medications that didn't work for me. And I felt it was so difficult for me to make the appointment with the doctor in the first place, that going back to say, well, these drugs aren't working. These drugs are making me sleep all the time. These drugs are keeping me awake all night, which was, you know, the opposite effect when I changed medication. That was a struggle. And coming to terms with the fact that it has taken me 20 years now to realise that you can't cure it. No. It's there, and you can find ways of making it better. And the one thing that took me the longest time to find out made me feel better was to talk about it. I thought it was something to be ashamed about that was very rare and nobody would understand, and people would just think it was an excuse. So I didn't really tell anybody about it. And once I started to, from being in my mid-20s, it was better. And now I'm someone who's like, yeah, all right, yeah, this is me. I'm having a black dog day. I'm feeling grim. I hope you understand that, you know, I don't feel like coming out today. And, you know, your friends go, okay.
Did you tell your mum at the time or?
Yeah, she was one of the very few people I told. My mum and my stepdad I told. And my mum is a nurse. She's a background in nursing. So she understood. My stepdad didn't understand what was up. So he would make the occasional joke about being mad, which I'd told him off about. And he, thankfully, is somebody who's very open to learning. And so even then, I remember explaining to him, I said, you know, there's this sort of 1 in 4 people probably have suffered from depression this year. And he said, really? I said, yeah, mental health it's a bigger thing than you realise. And so he's someone who goes away and learns more about things, and he wants to offer support. So that was nice. But then telling the rest of the family and telling my friends, it's something that I kept from a lot of people for a very long time. And now you don't get to shut up about it. They're probably sick of me.
And how do you deal with it now then? Are you still on medication? Do you do therapy?
I'm not currently on medication. I do try and save that for really bad episodes, and thankfully not had one of those for a few years now. I've worked out which medication I need to go and ask for as well. Right. I go on my fluoxetine, and that usually just helps to level out a bit. The other thing that I found that I hadn't matched up the behaviour with the outcome for so long is music. That has helped me. I can't explain how much singing particularly and playing music has helped me. And I just did not realise the correlation between, you know, going to the ukulele group on a Wednesday, Thursday felt great all day. Oh, and really? There is something about the hormones that are released into your body when you do something like that. It becomes the physical pushback of the chemicals against the bad chemicals. And finding that one thing that, for me, it's not a permanent cure, but it's a temporary patch. If I'm feeling rubbish, now I know I'm going to stick Spotify on, whack some tunes on that I know all the words to, and belt it out and drive my next door neighbour mad. But that'll make me feel that little bit better and feel enough better, if you get me, to survive.
That's like your
survive.
Little release of endorphins. Like, some people love to go to the gym, go for a walk, go for a run or whatever. Yours is singing, listening to something you love.
Yeah.
And what do you feel like then is your trigger? Do you know what your thing is? Can you tell when you're kind of going spiralling back down?
It's sometimes hard for me to tell exactly what it is that causes a bit of an episode. Sometimes it's being bored. Sometimes it's not having things to do. And then sometimes it's being too busy and wishing I had nothing to do and wishing I could just have a day under a duvet watching Grey's Anatomy. Which, for me, that if I'm watching Grey's Anatomy, that is actually a symptom.
It's just your coping mechanism.
Yeah, just turn that off and put something a bit more cheerful on where, you know, not everybody dies in a plane crash every 5 minutes.
It's
always a disaster. I don't really know why I watch that. I can tell there's almost like these physical, I can feel like there's a little prickle at the back of my brain.
Really?
Yeah. Or there's more intrusive thoughts. And I do struggle with intrusive thoughts and recognising that they are a symptom of my depression and anxiety is an absolute key. I just thought this is absolutely bonkers that whenever I am upstairs, say in a theatre, if I get tickets for the gods, I can't concentrate on the show because I'm thinking, someone's going to fall off the side. I'm going to fall off the side. I'm just going to run down there and jump. I'm going to throw somebody off. These are all perpetually going round. You know, what if I went down the front and I dropped my phone and it hit someone on the head and it killed them? What if I then, you know, fell over the, and
really?
Yeah. So, and I thought that was really
unusual.
Why don't
you just not get those tickets?
Well, I don't. They see now. No, I always sit in the stalls. Key number one.
Yeah.
And that's, and I think that is, having looked into why these things happen, I think that's quite a common symptom of, you know, anxiety and of being somebody who is kind of hyper aware of their surroundings. And I think it's actually quite a lot more common in women.
Mm. Oh,
It's the chimp bit of your brain is going, right, where's the danger here? Let's identify the big risks. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, the primeval bit of your brain desperately wants to protect you and your brood. So you want to make sure everything is super safe. So recognizing that is it's daft, but you can't really control that kind of thought.
Mm. And it's so weird, isn't it? Like, I've had exactly the same things. Like you said, like, what if I throw that person over there?
Yeah.
That's like something you're never going to do. Yeah. Why would you ever do
what
it?
What if I just veer the car?
Yeah, but there's part of your brain that's like, what if though? What if I did?
And I think that's actually, having looked into it, it's a sign of a really healthy brain, because you are just being so aware of your surroundings that you want to be careful, and I think it ties in for me with, I'm obsessed with true crime, so I'm on true crime podcasts all the time. Murder, murder, murder sends me to sleep.
Right.
And I think that is a symptom of this. It ties in with all the same stuff, being aware of risks,
mm-hmm.
and wanting to know what is the worst case scenario. When you think of it like that, you think, oh, it's not that bad to have those intrusive thoughts.
But was you like that when you were younger?
I think I've got more anxious as I've got older.
Mm.
It's quite a common thing. You know, little kids will be throwing themselves around on trampolines and on climbing frames. And I would have done that. And now I look at it and go, there's no, ice skating. I tried ice skating after 25 years. No, I was convinced I was going to, you know, shatter my femur and bleed to death on the ice or something like
that's
that.
So specific.
Yeah. You know, it used to be, if you fall over, someone's going to skate over your fingers and chop them off. That used to be the rumour. But
I used to
throw myself around the ice rink when I was a kid. No fear whatsoever. And now, no, it's far too risky.
I do think that happens, though. Like, I've always gone skiing and snowboarding and, now, I still enjoy it, but now every time I'm going down a mountain, I'm thinking, someone's going to take me out, or I'm going to hit my head and then I'm going to die, and or I'm going to go off the edge of the cliff, like, you know, because that happens all the time, even though I don't go anywhere near off piste or anything remotely dangerous, you know.
But I think that's something to do with getting older. For you, it's to do with being a mother as
100%, yeah.
So you've always got that in the back of your mind, you know, what if. But I think it's, you know, it's healthy, if sometimes a bit debilitating. And if it means you have to pay an extra tenner for your ticket for the theatre, then, you know, I think I can cope with that.
Yeah, I think you should, yeah. Open Mind the podcast is sponsored by very.co.uk. Looking for the perfect party outfit? Head to very.co.uk for all the latest trends to kick off the holiday season. So if music is this thing for you that you say makes you feel so great, then X Factor Celebrity must have been just a 100% yes then.
It was tough to actually decide that I was going to do it. It took ages for me and my agent were having this back and forth for a couple of months about what a risk it was. I mean, for him, the risk was, you know, if it's an absolute car crash for you, if you go and you croak out a song and it's dreadful and you get torn to shreds by Simon Cowell, the damage to your brand, your reputation, to work going forwards, how do you come back from that? And for me, the risk was the risk of rejection, which, you know, it's something that I'm particularly sensitive to, having, you know, I've used therapy in the past and counselling to try and figure out why, you know, the reasons behind some of my mental health problems, and some of that it's to do with rejection and its attachment, and, you know, being rejected by someone who shouldn't be rejecting you. basically. Mm-hmm. And so that's a slightly triggery thing for me to think that I could have a very, very public rejection in front of millions of people was potentially not going to do my mental health any good. On the other hand, I looked at the fact that we were going to get vocal training, which is something I've wanted to do for a long time and not really invested my time in that side of my abilities because I've been focused so much on the chase. And these experiences that we were told we're getting, we're going to go to LA and I've never been there before and that was very exciting. So it was weighing that risk up, and that the risk of rejection was very strong, and it was working out just how resilient I was feeling. And by the time decision day came to say yes or no, I must have just been feeling super resilient that day. I must have been having, if it's in the summer, I've got more sunlight, I was probably feeling quite good about the clocks had probably just gone forward. So it was all nice and bright. And yeah, so it was a tough decision to do that and face the rejection. And the fact is I faced the rejection and I was rejected and I was really angry. They didn't show that. They didn't actually have the cameras on me when I got, they didn't, they said I wasn't going through to the live shows. And I was furious.
With who?
With them. With the panel. Because I thought they'd made a terrible decision. Which is really unlike me to be confident. I usually would have been, I should have done this better, I should have done that. And I knew that I could not have done better at my first audition. I walked out there and I went into, for some reason, the vixen persona of just being completely automatic. She took over. I didn't feel anxious. I didn't feel nervous. Just went out there and smashed it as best as I could with, just a couple of weeks of vocal training. I'd watched the other act and I thought, okay, if we're going on vocal ability.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, there were some that got through that if I was you, I would have been like, are you fucking joking me?
It was a bit, yeah, it was like that. I was thinking, I don't see why they rejected me. And the only reason I could think that they rejected me was because, Louis Welsh always says, you look like a pop star, you sound like a pop star. I might have sounded like a pop star, but I don't look like a pop star. And that's the only thing I can think of that they didn't pick me to go through in the first place. And that's the worst of all for me. That's not just rejection. That's rejection on my physical appearance, which is, again, something I've had to, struggle with my demons over. And I've got to a place of acceptance of myself and I love myself and I don't really want to change myself all that much. I think I'm great, which is a wild thing for me to say, considering where I was maybe 5 years ago and hating myself. So I was absolutely furious. It was probably about 5 a.m. over here and I was on the phone to my agent, like crying and having a good howl down the phone to him. And he was just as furious as I was, even though he'd not seen the audition. And it took until the actual screening of the show for him to realise why I was so angry and upset. He was annoyed for me.
So how long was it after then? Because then you got called back in it, right?
Yeah.
So how long was it from the rejection to then this, we want you back in?
It was a very long time.
Really?
It felt like forever. It was a matter of weeks, but it still felt like...
But that's still a long time to go from, I put myself up for this. It took everything I had to be like, fine, I'd been backwards and forwards. You put yourself in that position and then you're like, okay, that's not happening anymore.
Yeah, I was so... I was really angry, so I cried all my makeup off and went back to my hotel room. Everyone else in the cast was going out for their big LA night out that we'd saved up for after the reveal. And I didn't go. I stayed in my hotel room and drank a couple of glasses of wine and ate a lot of sweets and put myself into a sugar coma. That's the only way I could get to sleep. So I missed out on that. And then I was furious in the car on the way to the airport and was there with Victoria, one of the other contestants, and she kind of talked me down a little bit, and I had the flight back, and by the time I got back I thought, well, it's done now.
Their loss.
Yeah, because it felt like a different, because it was a different country and it didn't feel real. Well, when it's on telly, people get mad and they'll tweet about it and there we go. So I actually had time to get to grips and come to terms with the fact that I'd had this rejection and it was done. So next. We have to wait for it to be on TV and then...
And then how did you end up coming back in it?
It was sort of out of the blue that I literally got a phone call from Simon Cowell himself to
really?
Say...
That's normal. He Hello. Hello,
well,
Jenny.
I should have known. They sent a film crew around to my house. I'm like, all right. And
oh, really?
There he was. Yeah, they didn't actually show the footage in the end. But this phone call from Simon, because he wanted to tell me personally that they'd made a mistake.
Right.
And
well, at least he knows.
I know it was a very tough situation because they already had put through more acts than they'd intended to from the first audition because the standard was so high. And then in our age category, the overs, we had the added problem that Vinnie Jones had signed up to be on the show, but literally a week before we were filming in LA, his wife died. And it was the most awkward situation because he kind of wanted to continue because it's what Tanya wanted, but also was really struggling. So he couldn't come to the audition in the first place. And Simon was saying, well, it's not fair to not give him the chance. Mm. So you understand that we're going to put him through because he said that he's willing to do the live shows. And I said, oh, that's absolutely fine. He said, but that's also not fair on you because you absolutely smashed your audition. So we are going to put you through as well. So that was, I could see it was a very tough decision for Simon and the producers to have to make. And I guess that kind of just fired me up again because I thought, well, I've not exactly got an apology.
Yeah.
I've got sort of an admission that they were slightly wrong in the first place, not putting me through. I've got this second chance. So I want to prove them wrong for not putting me through, and I want to prove them right for choosing to put me through in the end.
Was there not a part of you that was like, no, didn't want me the first time?
No, I wanted to do the live shows. I've got this FOMO. I hate missing out. And to know that all that gang that I'd been hanging out with in LA were all getting this experience. And what really buoyed me up was the public response after seeing my first audition. And people were absolutely furious on my behalf.
Which must have felt amazing.
Yeah, it was great. I had my own hashtag, Justice for Jenny. That was so funny. You know, people were writing in to complain, and I guess people rang into ITV to have a whinge, as well as venting the spleen on social media. So that really did give me a boost to know that people were enjoying my performance so much. That they wanted to see more of me, and they were furious that they weren't getting the chance to. And at this point, you know, I kind of thought, oh, this is really exciting that I actually will get to tell them at some point very soon. I had to not tell them actually what was going to happen, what the twist was that they were going to put me through anyway. And then this wave of love that I got when they actually announced that I was going through. And after that was been, that's honestly what's carried me through. It's been an exhausting process. And I never thought I would get to the final. Because I was kind of hoping for a couple of weeks. I was like, oh, get like halfway through and get voted off and I'll have a couple of weeks rest. No, it wasn't to be. They certainly squeezed every bit of energy out of me.
Oh no, mate, you were 100% going to the finals. Absolutely no chance of going home. But I feel like we did see that with you. Like, you just seemed, you were very open on the show about your insecurities and everything. And I think that was just like a breath of fresh air for everyone. And I think, as I say, like, seeing you on The Chase, we didn't know you. You are this character. And I know from meeting you that time after the ITV party, like, you are so different to what you are on The Chase. And it's obviously, it's so weird. Why wouldn't you be? But you just take everyone for face value, don't you, on TV? You just do. So I think it was nice. But how was that for you? It must have been really exposing.
Yeah. It's parceled in with the risk of doing a reality show like that where people are going to see much more of you than they ever knew existed. Because they, especially when you're playing sort of a character role, like the Vixen is very much, you know, she's almost one-dimensional. She's a front. And people kind of feel that that's all there is to you. And so the more unreal they think you are, the more that they feel that they can, you know, people on Twitter will, you know, do their worst if they don't think you've got any feelings. And I think now people realise I do have feelings and I've shared them and I've cried a few tears. It's quite a refreshing thing that people like me all the more for that. Mm. That could have been the worst thing, is I'd gone out there being myself 100% and people gone, nah, not keen on her, thought her out. And that must really, really hurt. Really, really hurt. I thought this is going to be the kind of platform I may never have again. So I just wanted to go out there, be honest about myself, and to highlight some of the things that I've been through and some of the things that I believe. And, you know, I didn't see anyone else out of all the acts, as much as I love them. They were very pop. And I thought, well, I've got this platform and I can make political points here. I mean, not in terms of party politics, but the fact that I ended up dancing with drag queens in front of big rainbow flags to Lady Gaga was an absolute highlight for me, because that was the thing I wanted to highlight, is acceptance and representation and how important that is for everybody's mental well-being. Because if you're all you're seeing on TV is people who look a certain way, and that way isn't how you look, or people whose lifestyle is a certain way and it's not something that you even want, let alone achieve, that's only going to make you feel awful.
Because you spoke out a lot after you'd sung and stuff about confidence and, you know, doing things you never thought you'd be able to do, and saying to people, if there's something you want, you need to just kind of go for it and you can make it happen. And not everyone uses those positions to do that.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, that was...
Yeah, I knew it would be a waste if I didn't use the, you know, the 15 seconds that you get at the end of your song. You know, Dermot puts a microphone next to your mouth and you just have to say something. Mm. And I felt like I needed to share what I'd learned each week, if you get what I mean. So I've come to a realisation about, you know, not wanting to be settled just for ordinary, just because other people think that you should be, you know, stay in your little box, stay in your hutch, stay in your hometown, stay, you know, doing an ordinary job, don't take any risks. You know, stay, you know, a lot of people are still pretending to be someone they're not because they don't want to upset people around them. And that makes me really sad. So I think that's something that was shown to me quite early on in the journey. And then more realizations about overcoming the odds and overcoming your worst critic. And your worst critic is always yourself. It's always that nasty voice. I hate that nasty voice. The worst thing is it's my own voice. And yeah, drowning that out and using it was like a tidal wave of love that I've had. And I kind of want to print out every nice Twitter comment and put it on my wall as wallpaper, and so I can look at it forever.
And what's, like, now that it's finished, like, how do you feel now? Because you must have just been on this massive high every week, kind of just like running on adrenaline, like your whole life changed for how long was it?
It's eight weeks I was sort of in the thick of it. It was, yeah, 6 weeks of live shows and all the prep that went with it. Mm. Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm literally jet lagged, even though I've not been on a plane.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure what time zone it is. Still waking up like I was during X Factor, waking up suddenly at 2 a.m. and, you know, trying to run lyrics. What's wrong with me? Or getting excited about the next day if it was a show day. You know, you couldn't really sleep that well the night before, even though you were exhausted. So now I've still got that. I've got the excess of adrenaline that's still keeping me awake when I should be sound asleep. It's going to take a while to come to terms with it, because it still doesn't really feel like it happened even. Mm. In some ways, I feel like I've been time travelling. So, you know, I got in the TARDIS and suddenly a week later, it's December. What happened?
It's Christmas.
It was September a minute ago. And yeah, it's going to take a bit of wrapping my head round to figure out what discoveries I've made about myself, and have all that sort of filter down and embed in into my unconscious. And I just have to keep channeling that joy and that sort of the difference between where I was a few years ago to where I am now. And I can't possibly let any of that roll back. I have to keep rolling forward and keep pushing myself. And just being an example that, you know, people can be in a very dark place and in a really bad place. And it's possible to change it as long as you don't give up on yourself. I nearly gave up on myself for quite a few times. And the best decisions I ever made were those times when I decided to persist in existing and push myself forward and keep going. Because, you know, the bit of my brain that has got louder and louder, the positive bit, saying you are worth it. You are important. You can make a difference to the world. It's essential to keep that little voice and keep amplifying it. And now that little voice is amplified across TVs across the nation, because I've been saying all this on national TV, and I'm trying to give all that back to help people who are in a situation I was, you know, earlier this decade.
Well, I'm so glad you persisted, and I'm sure there are so many people out there that are. Like, I've just sat here with a big smile on my face the whole time you've been speaking. It's just, I don't know, it's so exciting to hear someone that's, like, found their way and come from where you have come, and, you know, you seem in such a great place. You've put yourself out there and you've got nothing but love back. And I just know that there's so many people out there that have been watching that don't feel great, or don't feel like they can achieve what they want to achieve, or don't feel like they fit in, and now they can look at you and say, okay, well, she's done it, and yeah, you know, nothing, the world didn't end,
yeah,
so I can do it. So well done, congratulations. Like, personally and career wise I mean, you, the only way is up now, and I can't wait to see what you do next. So
same. I'm excited, but I'm hoping to get some sleep in before I have to do anything now.
Sleep is important. It's important.
Self-care.
Yeah, well, I'll let you go and sleep. Thanks for coming and talking to me. Like, honestly, I was so excited to have you on. When I saw you on the show, I was like, I need to have her, but you were so blooming busy. So I'm glad that X Factor's finished. And you're the perfect person for me to finish the series on. I just know everyone's going to love listening to this and be inspired. So thanks.
Well, thank you for having me and inviting me. And yeah, hopefully people will take something from my story. And
They will.
Lift somebody up. That's what I want.
Thank you. I just want to say a massive thank you to Jenny and all my other guests that I've had on for Series 1 of Open Mind, and we'll be back in the new year with Series 2. This episode of Open Mind the podcast was sponsored by very.co.uk.